right?
Correct.
B-E-A-T-T-Y.
That is correct.
All right. When were you born?
I was born Asheville, North Carolina, April the 24th, 1909.
And you, when did you leave then?
I left Asheville, it must have been 1925, mm-hmm. after the death of my father. My mother died first, and then my father died, and I came to Detroit to live with my sister, Esther O'Donnell. We're still living in Detroit now.
And then you went to high school?
I went to North, entered Miller Intermediate School in Detroit in the seventh grade, and I went through the ninth grade. I went to high school at Northeastern High in Detroit, and graduated from Northeastern High School in Detroit. I entered Eastern Michigan University in the fall of 1930, and I graduated from Northeastern High and entered, came to Eastern Michigan after graduating from high school. Mm-hmm.
And then you, I guess I have to get in. What attracted you to Eastern? To what can you?
Well, let's put it this way. I had established a pretty good track record at Northeastern High School as a runner. Mm-hmm. And of course, when I first came, I didn't know anything about running. I thought everybody was supposed to run anyhow. So I ran. I had never seen a track meet. And so when I first got to Miller in a gym class, the man lined up everybody at the end of that day and into the class. And we had to run into the shower, which is about 125 yards. So he'd line up maybe 20 or 30 boys, and he'd say, "On your marks, get set," and he'd hit against the fence with a baseball bat, and that group would take off. The next group would come up, bang, take off until all the gym class kids were in. So I wanted to be the first in the shower, and I got in the shower, and I was taking the shower, and in came one of the coaches. I didn't know who he was or anything. He said, "You, I want you to come to my office." I didn't know what I'd done. I knew I hadn't gotten any fights because I didn't fight. So he asked me what my name was, and I told him. He said, "How long you been here?" I said, "Oh, I've only been here about a week." And he said, "Did you ever run track?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, I want you to come out for track practice this afternoon." So I went out for track practice that afternoon, and I didn't know what was happening. The whole school was out. What had happened in the race that I ran in to take a shower, in my group of guys, about 20 of us, they had the fastest runner in the school, named Fred Calloway. And word got around that we got somebody here to beat Fred Calloway, see? And so he ran us three separate races that afternoon, just the two of us. And each time I beat Fred. And that's when I found out that I could run, you know. So I was quite successful in high school, establishing several high school world records. And naturally, people in colleges were seeking out me. Yeah. I had a chance to go to Michigan, to Michigan State, Northwestern University. Practically every school in the Big Ten had heard about me because of the National Interscholastic Track Meet. Mm-hmm. And Eastern had wanted me, but I had no thought about coming to Eastern. Mm-hmm. I got a job working at Ford Motor Company during that summer, and was working in the foundry. And of course, that was pretty tough work. Anyway, these colleges, I had my mind set on going to Northwestern University because I had gone there for a national high school track meet, and I'd met some fine people, and they were quite interested, and they told me what they were going to give me and everything. And so, but I didn't start when school started, and they kept after me, calling me, and so I had intended to work until the second semester, but in the meantime, I got laid off. And so when I called Northwestern, they asked me to go to some other school in Michigan because freshman week had already passed, and then transfer to Northwestern the second semester. So I knew that someone from Eastern had called me, which was Michigan State Normal College at that time, so I didn't want to stay out of school. So I went to Michigan State Normal, talked to one of the coaches, and they were expecting me. So I didn't have any credit sent there at all. We had a registrar by the name of C.P. Stimley, and so he called my high school principal and said, now, can you recommend this guy? He said, yes, sure. He's one of our fine students, see. And so I entered on his word, but my credits were sent later. Mm-hmm. And once I got here, I liked it so well, I just stayed, see. Mm-hmm.
And you, of course, that was an entire new experience, too, that coming in and having the opportunities to compete on college level. You, once you got here, what were some of the competitive races that you entered? Like, I mean, I guess I'm thinking about some of those
ones. I had, in high school, I ran the hurdles, and I did the broad jump, mm-hmm. and I had held a national interscholastic world record indoors for a half mile. Then I competed on the mile relay team for Northeastern High School, and also on the half mile. Mm-hmm. And our team had set a world record for the half mile relay at 1:30. And of course, during that time, you ran on a cinder track, and the time now is so different because they have these synthetic tracks, you know, and regardless of what the weather is, you can make good time. But in the case of a rain, the track was slow and things of that nature, see. So when I got to college, the coach had me concentrate on the broad jump and the hurdles, and I ran a leg on the relay team. But so far as running half mile, that was out. I tried to high jump when I was in high school, and because I just didn't know what I could do, and high jump was just too much. I was short. I did jump 5'8", and once or twice, but that was good for a guy my height.
Yeah.
And I tried to pole vault, and I got over 10 feet once, and that was extreme. No, I beg your pardon, 8 feet, and I thought that was extremely good, because the world record was only 12'8" at that time. See? And now it's over 18 feet.
Yeah.
So I more or less specialized when I got to Eastern Michigan now, which is Michigan State Normal then. And I took part in the high hurdles and the low hurdles. There was a track meet coming up at University of Pennsylvania known as the Penn Relays. It had been a long-established event, and they had the 400-meter hurdles. So my teammate, Red Simmons, and myself asked our coach to let us go to Penn Relays, because we always had gone to Drake Relays prior to that time. Mm-hmm. So we finally convinced him that we'd like to enter in those 400-meter hurdles. So he says, okay, we'll go. And we didn't have any 400-meter hurdle. The height of a 400-meter hurdle is 3 feet. The height of a low hurdle is 2'6".
Oh,
and the height of a high hurdle is 3'6". So he had a 6-inch addition made so we could put on the top of each hurdle to give us the height of an intermediate hurdle. So he did that, and we went out. We used to practice in Yost Fieldhouse because it was in the wintertime. And we could not compete outside. Every now and then we'd get a good day and we'd go out and work out, because this track meet was one of the first outdoor meets of the year, and it always came in April. And around here, you're lucky to get weather that you can run in April. So we went out there, and the first year, 1931, I won the 400-meter hurdles, and my teammate got a third. The second year, I won the hurdles, and my teammate got third. He got second that year. The third year, 1933, we had the banks had all broken. We had money in the banks. It was frozen. We couldn't get to it. So the coach wanted me to try to defend my title for the third year. And so they put tin cans around all over Ipsy and helped send Beatty to the Penn Relays. And so that's how I got to Penn Relays the third year, in order to defend my my title. And after I had gotten there, the news had reached Detroit that I didn't have a way to get there, so the Greyhound bus line, no, not the Greyhound, Michigan Central Railroad track had offered me a ticket. But by the time I had to leave early, and I took the bus, and I didn't have a chance to take the train. But a train ticket was offered to me and to get there. But I did get there, and I defended my title for the third straight year. In 1932, I set the record there that stood for 18 years. And in 1932, that was the Olympic year, see. So I was established in 1932 as the outstanding 400-meter hurdler in not only in the country, but in the world, and until the Olympic Games. During the Olympic Games tryouts, I defeated everybody. We're only picking three, and we had...
The Olympic Games would be 34?
1932.
32,
and I met in California, Los Angeles.
I see.
And the thing about it was that I'd had quite an easy time up until the final race, only four men in the race, and we were picking three. And I had lane number one. These lanes were staggered. Number one was the inside lane. Number two was about 7 yards ahead of number one. Mm-hmm. But you had to run in your entire lane during the entire race.
Yeah.
And if you got out of that lane, then you'd be disqualified. Glenn Harding had lane four, which put him about 12 to 15 yards ahead of me. But the distance was made up on the curves. But if you dropped out of lane four down to lane three, then you're not running 400 meters.
Yeah.
But what happened, I had judged my time, and when I hit the straightaway with about the last 60 yards, here somebody was ahead of me. And so I caught him, but in catching him, I used up the speed that I was reserving for the final spurt. And in so doing, I tipped the last hurdle, which knocked me off stride. And I maintained my balance and without falling until about 5 yards from the finish line, and then I lost my balance and fell. Even during the time that I was stumbling and couldn't get myself together, I was still out in front. And so when I got up, naturally all the other three fellas passed me, because we had the four fastest runners in the country in that one heat. Mm-hmm. And so naturally they weren't too far behind. So they went by me, and I got up and I walked across the finish line. And I mentioned to the coach that I'm finishing this race. So I went into the locker room very dejectedly, naturally, something I'd looked for all my life. And then one of the newspaper reporters came in who had won the 400-meter dash in the 1928 Olympics. And he sought me out and he said, "Did you know that Glenn Harding ran the wrong hurdles?" And I said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" I said, "What can I do about it?" He said, "Let's go out and talk to Mr. Brundage." And Mr. Brundage was chairman of the Michigan Amateur Athletic Union and also a member of the Olympic committee. So the first thing he asked me, "Did you finish the race?" And I said, "Yes, I finished the race." So they disqualified Glenn Harding because he did not run 400 meters at all. He not only dropped down from lane four, he dropped down to lane two, which gave him a decided advantage, and he ran less. So, however, Mr. Brundage didn't mention what Monday, that was a Saturday, and that Monday never came. He went back and he selected Glenn Harding to run in place of me. The excuse was that one of the officials helped me to my feet, which was not true. I got up and walked across the finish line myself. And, of course, the Los Angeles papers knew the whole story, and they criticized Mr. Brundage severely for doing that, but he was the czar, and that's the way it stood. So that's how I missed out on the Olympic Games.
That was
1932. Mm-hmm. And Glenn Harding, who won the race, went on and won the Olympic Games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, after that, of course, you went on and finished.
Well, I finished, I went on, graduated from Eastern, and 1934, of course, this is during the Depression time, and jobs are hard to get. So Lord Olds, my track coach, was constantly looking out for me and his other athletes, and there was a job open here in Ypsilanti at Harriet School, now known as Perry Child Development Center, and he interceded for me, and I had an interview, and I got the job teaching fourth grade. And I stayed right here in Ypsilanti because I liked it. And then in 1940, I was made principal of that particular school, see. Go ahead, that's all.
Well, I was just going to say, at the time you went into Perry as a teacher, How many other black teachers were there?
We had one black teacher, very fair-complected person, who, very light woman. She had taught 1 year prior to my getting there, and then she taught my first year. She taught second grade. Mm-hmm. Then she left and went to Detroit and taught there and just finished up recently, retiring from the Detroit Public Schools.
What's her name?
Her name was Louise Conger. She's now Louise Marshall, see. Wow. And her husband was also a teacher in Detroit, and he has recently retired also, see.
Well, now at that time, because this is now, you're talking about
1935.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 1935 was the school over here on... Adams Street.
No, that school had long been closed, long before I even knew it was a school. It was a sort of a one-room school, most of the blacks went to that school, mm-hmm. See, who lived on this side.
That means then that Mrs. Kersey, where was Mrs. Kersey teaching then?
Mrs. Kersey was not a teacher. She did her first teaching with me. She had not taught school at that time.
Oh, no, she taught at the old school, Adams.
I guess we'd call it Adams. Well, at least she was not teaching at that time and did not teach for years until I had become principal.
Oh, okay.
Then when I became principal, I hired Olive Evans, who was previously Olive Kersey, and then Bernice Kersey, who later... had received her degree by that time. Mm-hmm. So she taught at Adams. It was prior to my time, and had not received a degree, but she did receive a degree and taught at Harriet School with me.
Mm-hmm.
We had a beautiful combination between Bernice Kersey and Olive Evans, who at once was a Kersey, and they both were music. Mm-hmm. One played the piano while the other directed.
Oh, yeah.
And Bernice played the piano and Olive did directing.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, we had some very outstanding programs. We had a radio program that we put on with our youngsters, and Olive did the directing while Bernice played.
Mm-hmm.
And barring any other elementary school anywhere, we had the greatest musical program of anybody, mm-hmm. see. And the kids had an opportunity to put plays on, and they didn't have to be just a maid. They were everything. Kings, queens,
mm-hmm.
court people, and so on. I say that because in some of the mixed schools, when you have a few blacks in the school, they would be the butler or the maid or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that never happened in our place.
When you were at Michigan Normal, how many other blacks were there?
We had seven black men. I could name them all. Just seven black men, about 25 or 30 women. That was all at that time. And four of us all lived in one building. In fact, no, there were five of us lived in one home. At that time, Easton did not have any integrated housing at all, see. I recall very strongly we had a girl from Jackson, Michigan that was taking home economics. And one of the requirements was to live in this house, this housekeeping place where everybody taking home economics had to live there for at least one semester.
Mm-hmm.
They waived that for this girl because they did not want her to live there, see? And she lived at our house at that time, see? And by this time now, I'm married and I'm teaching at Ipswich, and this very home here we built in 1941, see? And anyway, things had have changed tremendously. We had Dean of Men was James Bingo Brown. I tell you this because everybody loved James Brown. We had every week we had what we call the Kresge dances, and students would pay 10 cents to go in the old gymnasium and we'd dance. McKinney Union was under construction at that time, and every time we paid our registration fee, which was three times a year, they took a certain amount of money from us to help build McKinney Union, see? When they built McKinney Union, they moved the Kresge dances there. Now, with our six black kids, black boys on campus, I don't know who it was, but they did not want us to go to those dances because the black boys would dance with the white girls.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bing Brown called us in one day, and he didn't tell us we couldn't do this, but it was an indication that they did not want us. Well, three of the fellas were sort of not militaristic, but they wanted to stand up for their rights, and so we met with Bingo to ask him why, see. Well, Bingo died and never told us, but we had no more trouble getting into the Kresge dances, see. And those people, some of us didn't go, but after that, every boy on campus went, see. And we got all the girls to go, see. Bingo was smart enough man, and an intelligent enough man to withhold whatever he wanted to tell us. And he said, well, we'll get back with you. So he never got back with us, and we made all the Kresge dances, see. If we had backed down at that time and not have gone to these dances, no telling what could have happened. We would have been fostering the segregated pattern that they wanted us to have, see. So that was, but Bing was a very fine person. Everybody loved him. He had a very strong voice, and he was dynamic and very touching. And
his nickname was
Bingo Brown. Mm-hmm. See? James Bingo Brown.
I've heard some stories.
At once, he was a state of Michigan boxing commissioner.
Oh, see?
He came from, I think it was Cornell University here. He was a football player in his day. See?
I guess the thing I was getting around to, in our interview the other day, we discovered a woman who graduated from Michigan State Normal in 1916. But she says at that time they would not give her a certificate to teach. They gave her a certificate of graduation, but not a teaching certificate.
Mm-hmm.
And she said they wouldn't give it to her unless she had a job.
Mm-hmm.
But she couldn't get a job in 1916 in Ypsilanti. That's what she said. And she said if she had wanted to leave town and go down south someplace, she could have gotten a job, and then they would have given her a certificate.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this was all a little bit unusual for me. And particularly when I had this picture, I have this picture of the teachers at Adams School. And that's the reason I knew about Miss Kersey,
yes,
because Miss Kersey is on that picture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I knew that they had always had teachers there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, and of course I haven't even checked this with Easton, but I wanted to verify the fact that they were withholding teaching certificates,
mm-hmm.
at least up to
that. That I didn't know anything at all about, mm-hmm. because when we came through and they were giving, you know, mm-hmm. whatever you earn, mm-hmm. you receive that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before my time, so I don't know anything about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, then in other words, in 19, but while you were there, at least they broke down that practice of barring you from the dances. I suspect, though, that when you went to the dances, most of you still danced with your own folks. Huh?
Well, I did, but we had a couple of fellas that didn't. They made a purpose of just going ahead, because I never danced those girls anyhow,
mm-hmm.
see. I hadn't been up in Bigfoot country long enough to get used to that stuff, so I never danced with them anyhow. But we had two fellas that, you know, that did, and I'm glad they did,
yeah.
because I just hadn't been used to that, and because we had plenty of girls on campus,
mm-hmm.
plenty of black girls, and we were nice looking girls and fine girls, and so there was no reason for us to.
No. Now, I guess the thing I want to ask you about right through here is I want to ask you about your wife. When did you meet? Under what circumstances did you meet?
Well, Evelyn.
When?
I met Evelyn at a dance one night. No, I'm sorry. I met her at a track meet. I was at Eastern, and she was at the University of Michigan. And she had a friend, boyfriend, by the name of John Johnson, who had told her about this fella that he thought was one of the greatest runners that he'd ever seen, greatest hurdlers. Because at that time, we didn't have many black hurdlers throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that time, there was Ned Gordine, who had run hurdles for Iowa, I think, or one of the schools out somewhere in the Middle West. But in this part of the country, we just didn't have anybody who had run hurdles. And he had seen me run, and we had a meet at the University of Michigan Fieldhouse, and he wanted her to go see this person, see. So she came out, and she thought that, she said, he thinks he's kind of cute or something, because said he kept, so why does he keep running and skipping over hurdles? And he explained to her, well, he's warming up, you know. He said, you have to warm up so when the race starts, you won't pull a muscle, see? So when she saw me run, she understood why he was constantly bending and stretching his muscles and so on. And that was the first time that she had ever seen me. It so happened that we worked on a playground in Detroit one summer. And she was assigned to my playground. Well, I had worked during the summers on the playground, but she had never worked on it. She didn't know anything about athletics, but she was quite a smart girl in academic studies. Mm. So we had to take a civil service test. Mm. And she made it by excelling on the academic side, but when it came to the activities so far as shuttleboard, shuffleboard, tennis, track, all of those questions she didn't answer, but didn't know how. Some of them she hit at and did get good. Mm. So we were thrown together there, see. Mm. And her father was a dentist, and he brought her to the playground that day, and he had heard of me, but had never met me before. Her name was Evelyn Douglas. So anyway, Evelyn was an only child, and she didn't know anything about work. That was her first job. So we worked together, and she's kind of a girl that I liked. She was small and, you know, sort of petite and so on. So we got to know each other there. And so when he brought her to the playground, and he said, Beatty, Gene Beatty. No, he called me John Beatty. And I said, no, my name is Gene, see. So anyhow, he asked me to look after and take care of him. So we did, and we became acquainted, and we went out to a dance a couple of times. And that time I had to borrow some clothes because I hadn't worked long enough to earn money enough to. So anyway, that's how we met each other, and we got married in 1935, and we've been married ever since. So I have three kids.
And when did she graduate from Michigan?
She graduated from Michigan in 1932. She graduated from University of Michigan, School of Music. And then she went to Wayne State and got her teaching certificate in elementary education. And she taught kindergarten for 33 years in Detroit, see, and retired in 1975.
See. Now, you all married in 35, and then what about your children?
We got married November the 27th, 1935, and we didn't have any children for 6 years after we got married, and since that time we've had three children, who are all married now and all have children of their own.
Okay, give me the first child and the name of the first child and the date that child was born.
First child is Mary Louise, and she was born.
And her married name is now?
Mary Shorter.
Shorter.
Mm-hmm. And
what's her husband's first?
Her husband's first name is Donald.
Donald, right.
Mary Louise has three children. She has oldest daughter, but she has the youngest children. She has one child that just started to school last September. She's 5 and a half.
Her name?
Her name is Trelon.
Spell that.
T-R-A-Y-L-O-N-N-E.
Okay. Second child.
Second child is Danielle.
Danielle.
D-O-N-Y-E-L-L-E.
Okay.
Danielle is part of Donald's name, see?
Mm-hmm.
And she's 3 and a half. And the baby Trelon's birthday is January. Wait a minute. I can't think of it right offhand.
Okay, we're getting there.
And
the third child.
The third child is Donald. Donald Charles.
Donald
Shorter. And he will be 1 year old the 19th of January this year, 1981. See? And his birthday is January the 19th. The other two children are born in May. The oldest child is born May 4th, and the next one is born May 19th.
Okay.
That's Danielle.
Okay. Now, the second child.
Charlotte. Charlotte Jean, J-E-A-N. That's my middle child. And
her
last name is Jordan.
Jordan.
And she has the oldest daughter, Stacy. Stacy was born on S-T-A-C-E-Y. Uh-huh. Stacy was born. Now she has two. One born on the 20, 9th of May and the other is the 31st of May. Stacy was born on May the 29th. And Delice, D-U-L-E-C-E, is 13. And she was born on May the 31st. See, is just a day in between the two there, see. Charles, my son and the youngest, was born on May the 27th. And he has two children. And his children, the oldest, is 14 years of age. And her birthday is on in March. I don't know the exact date. And his son is Charles the Third.
Yeah.
And his birthday is August, the middle of August. I can't think of the exact date. See.
What's Charles's wife's name?
Charles' wife's name is Minnie. M-I-N-I. Her name. She was a Slater. S-L-A-T-E-R.
Slater. Mm-hmm. Is she a local? I mean, had her folks?
No, she was raised here, but she wasn't born here. I don't know where Minnie was born, but they came from a big family, and she's not the baby, but
no,
she's somewhere in the middle.
Okay, now, you came here now, you started working here in 1935, you got married in 1935.
Right.
And then you, I tell you one thing I wish you would tell me, if you can remember. When you first got married, where did you live?
We first got married, we rented a place on Harriet Street, just two doors from the school. The place was owned by Louise Mahaley. And Miss Mahaley just passed away here about a month ago. And we had an apartment upstairs. We lived there, and then the next year, my wife started a teaching in Detroit. And then she commuted, not every day, but she stayed at home in Detroit, and she'd come out on Wednesday and go back Thursday morning, then she'd come back Friday and spend the weekend and go back Monday morning. And we did that about a year, and then we purchased an automobile, and then she went back and forth for 33 years, and, every day.
And you first lived in this house on...
On here, 430... It's called 433 Harriet Street at that time.
Still there?
The house has been torn down. It's right on the corner of Perry and Harriet Street. And the school extends now. The yard extends all the way there. But there was two houses. One house was sitting on the property of the school, and it was a custodian's house. Then the other house sitting right next door to it, which would be east of the custodian's house, was Louise Mahaley owned. It was a two-family apartment, and we lived upstairs. We had one bedroom. We had sort of a little small dining room, a kitchen, and a living room and bath, see, which was big enough for the two of us. In 1940, we started negotiations to build the house we're in now. At that time, we purchased a lot and had the lot free and clear, and FHA was really coming into its own. But they would not build a house for us because they wouldn't build in this community. And I had tried every place conceivable to get money to build this home, and I couldn't get it. FHA came out and they looked and said, well, we won't build in this area. And said, go up around the college and purchase a lot and we'll build a home for you. And I said, well, I can't buy a lot up there for the same reason that you won't build a house for me, see, because they don't want any blacks up there. There was one black family living on Cross Street, which was the Curry family, and they had been there for years and years and years, and generations of them had worked at Eastern Michigan. And I think all of them are dead now except one of the male. They have one male and a sister, who is, her name is Mrs. Smith. Well, anyway, that family has lived there for all these years. They'd been living there prior to...
You said on Cross Street.
I'm sorry, it's on Washington.
Okay.
The lot extends all the way back to Cross Street.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, neither bank would build a house for me, so I finally talked to a fellow who had a house built, and he told me to go and see Mr. Harry Schaefer, who had a hardware store, and talk to him. So I did talk to him, and he talked to Mr. McAndrews, who was head of the Ypsilanti Association.
Savings and Loan
Association. And he said he'd give me, they'd give me 60%, but I'd have to have my lot free and clear in 40% of the house. And then I put my 40% in first, and then they would come through with the rest of it. Well, I wanted a house badly, and I says, okay. I did not have 40%, but I did have the lot free and clear. And on $1,500 a year salary, that was not too much. My wife was teaching in Detroit, making more money than I was, which didn't make any difference to me. But we went out and we borrowed money from our credit union here in Ipsy, and I booked number 83, and so that was kind of low. We hadn't started this school. Mm-hmm. So I borrowed the full amount that I could borrow, which is $500, and when the basement was in, I paid $500, see. When the roof was on, I had to pay another installment, $500, see. Well, by this time, I borrowed money everywhere I could, and I thought that if I got enough money into the place and got it up to a certain, I just took a chance at letting, I knew I wasn't going to have 40%. So I went back to Mr. MacAndrews, and I told him that I had exhausted all of my means, and if I keep borrowing money to put in to get 40%, that I'd never get a house built, see. And I just labored upon his, just feel that being a human being, that he wouldn't let me go down the drain. So he came out, he took a look at what was the roof was on, and I was lucky enough to get a man who was an expert builder and had built many, many homes in Ypsilanti, but had, for the past 2 years, had been ill and with underlying fever. So he gave me a break on the house, providing that I would let my house be shown to other people, of which I did. We could not build a house like we wanted to. It was supposed to be brick veneer, and so we changed from brick veneer to siding. He built the house like it was supposed to be, but he had to narrow the house down and make it smaller, see? And so Mr. MacAndrews came out, and he was amazed at it, and he says, tell your builder to come in and see me, and I'll give him the go-ahead sign. And that's how we got the house built, see. So, and several other homes in Ypsilanti has the same style because people came in to look at our house and wanted it built the same way, see. So,
now, to your general knowledge, what were the circumstances concerning black folks and their ability to get money to build a house at that time?
The ability to get money at that time was terrible. Absolutely terrible. We had some people, we had some nice homes owned by black people, old timers. I don't know how they got the money, but I suspect that the house that we lived in, Mr. Alfred Davis, it was a well-built home, solid, but he and other friends of his helped, they built each other the homes. Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful home on South Adams, Mrs. Dennis. 427 South Adams. She had a very beautiful home, and I just don't know how they did it, but I can't say how they did it, and I've never inquired, but I do know the local banks did not help these people build the house. You could get money, the banks would loan you money to buy automobiles, any kind of car you could buy, but they didn't want to take a chance on people with homes, because they would force you to live in this area,
yeah.
And they wouldn't loan you money to build on the other side of town. And they figured that they'd lose money, because if you didn't keep up your payments, they'd have to rent to some other blacks, because 95% of the blacks living in Ypsilanti live south of Michigan Avenue, see. It was just one of those things, you know. But a little later on, I think the first real big home that was built by a bank was built for Dr. Perry on South Hamilton Street. The bank let him.
And his wife.
Yes.
His widow lives in.
Yes, he's still there. And then a little later on, it was easy for you to get money, but it was too late for me.
Yeah. Tell me something else, Gene, about the time you started off here. Suppose you wanted. Well, tell me about the problem with insurance, or were you able to get any insurance that you wanted?
Well, I had taken out insurance. Company in Detroit, Great Lakes Mutual Insurance Company. I had to have enough insurance to cover, in case I should happen to die, cover the cost of the house. Metropolitan was the big insurance that black people, had insurance in. I had many people who came to me, but the rate was much higher because the black people were supposed to have longevity of life was not, lifespan was not as long as a white person. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you had to pay more for insurance. If I had gotten a $10,000 coverage, I couldn't have been able to keep up the premium because it was just too high.
Yeah.
But a white person could have gotten a $10,000 insurance policy and pay about half as much as we were paying at that time, see. Right now, the span, Negro span of life has increased, and it's not as tough now as it was then, see. It's the market has come closer together. But
did you get a mortgage insurance, or did you just take a life insurance?
Well, I had mortgage insurance, and I had life insurance also, see. The one that I had for Great Lakes, I had to have several insurances in case that I did die.
Yeah.
The insurance that I would receive would pay off the mortgage on the house, you see.
Well, now tell me this. When you got your life insurance, I guess that's the one I'm interested in. What kind of insurance was it? Was it the same kind of insurance that white folks get, or was that the same story?
It was the same kind of insurance, but we had to pay more for it.
It was an industrial insurance.
Yeah, I guess that's what. Yes, yes. But you paid more for it.
Yeah, see. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm asking that question specifically because I think that the problem was national.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
Even in the 40s, I went out to get insurance, mm-hmm. and the only kind of insurance I could get was industrial.
Mm-hmm.
And if I went through a black company, the only thing they sold was industrial.
Mm-hmm.
And if I went to a white company, the only time they'd sell me was industrial. I couldn't get a professional insurance mm-hmm. in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to verify the fact that this was true here as well.
Yeah,
as
well, I knew it was, because mm-hmm. all over the country it was like that, you know, so far as black people were concerned.
Yeah.
So.
Well, this, only in fairly recent years. In fact, it was only after I got here, or a little before I got here, I was able to get a really professional insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Of me and my occupation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now about time you started working here, of course, the Depression came. What I'm really trying to say, the war came.
Mm-hmm.
And the war brought about some changes. And I understand that when the war came, you were almost immediately placed on the draft board.
No, I didn't get on the draft board until Mr. Chappell had been on. I spent 15 years on the draft board. I think I went on the draft board in 1950. It's somewhere around 1950.
Oh, you weren't on it during the war.
Oh yes, I was not World War II.
That's what I mean. World War II.
No,
I was thinking World War II.
No.
I hadn't gotten down to
that. I was the first black to ever be placed on the
during
Selective Service
Force.
During
World War II, then there was no blacks on it at all.
No, not at all, not at all. And I spent 15 years on the draft board until.
Well, I want to get to that, but right now I want to cover this period of 1940.
Mm-hmm.
I want to find out what you were doing, the political activities. Other things that were going on in town around 1940. And I guess I want to give you a leading question now. There was a newspaper published by a friend across the street,
mm-hmm.
his widow, of course, I've talked to. But I haven't interviewed, but I want to talk to her about it. That paper was the Washtenaw
Sun.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, do you remember approximately the length of time that paper was published?
Well, I know during the 40s, late 40s, and in the 50s, he published that paper, see. And he did all the work right there in his house. I don't know where he had it printed or published, but the work was done in his house there. And he had several people working on him. Frank Seymour was one of the persons. He had several people out getting news, you know. And they liked sensational stuff, you know. And a lot of it was extremely biased, you know. But it had a lot of good points, too. I would say that he was, He had the first black publishing paper that was put out in Ypsilanti. And a lot of it was very good and kept you up to the time. They had a column for young people, a young people's column. And
you didn't by any chance keep a copy of that, did you?
I have a copy of I have a couple of copies of Washington Sun.
Well, of course, you know what I'm going to ask you. I'd like to make a copy of it.
Now, wait a minute. It may be a copy of the Sun, or it may be a copy that was... I don't think it's a copy of the Washington Sun. It's a copy of a little paper that was put out by the youth, and they had a lot of material in there that was published in the Sun, but a copy of the Sun itself I do not have, see.
That's what I've been trying to find. I'm trying to find copies of the Sun. Mm-hmm. Now, there was another little paper that was put out about that same time. Not at the same time, but near the end.
Miss Annie Simpson had...
Miss Simpson's paper.
Annie Simpson had a little paper that she...
Gossip sheet, something.
Yeah, and she's... sent around, and she would take around and deliver it herself in person to people, you know, see. And it was quite an informative little thing, and I have great respect for the woman because she was up in age, and she got around, and she let you know what the clubs were doing and things of that nature. And it was not really a paper that would down people, you know. If something happened, she'd print it, you know. She wouldn't sensationalize the thing, you know. See.
I've heard a lot of good comments about it, and about how well received it was.
Yes. So,
but I guess it's just one of those things I want to document. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see copies of it. Mm-hmm. And as you and I know, during that time, life was quite incident. Well, they would keep other papers in the library. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't pay attention to that.
Yes, that's right.
And of course, I don't know yet whether Mrs.
Warren. Francois
has copies of hers or not.
Well, she just might have a copy.
I have written her a letter, and I asked her for an interview, and I'm hoping she does. Now, on the other one, I'm hoping to run across somebody. There's a man who lives over there someplace who used to live with Miss Simpson, I understand. And somebody gave me his name, Mrs. Bass gave me his name, and said he might accidentally have a copy of me. Well, anyway, I was interested in that. Mm-hmm. Now, about that time, of course, you had a kind of an awakening during that period of the 40s, particularly. I think there was a kind of awakening political interest in black people. And I know it was national, and I also have a feeling that, I may be made to understand it was also local. In other words, tell me anything you can remember about that. About that time you elected Seymour, for example. Mm-hmm. What went on behind the scenes for the election of Seymour?
Well, Frank had moved out here. Frank was working, I think, out at General Motors, or the bomber plant, as we call it, but was living in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And I was the one that found him an apartment out here so he could live out here. And he lived right down the street here, 148 Hawkins, and he had a nice apartment. House is owned by John Davis, and he and his wife, lovely couple, and they didn't want anybody, although they built the apartment, they didn't rent it to anybody, so I convinced him that Frank was a fine person, and he turned out to be a fine person, clean and not noisy, not rough, or anything like that, so they let him have the apartment, which is about 4 or 5 doors from here. And at that time, we began to form committees and various clubs, and we became interested in politics, not that we hadn't been before. Ben Neely was one of the pioneers in the political movement here in Ypsilanti, and Ben is still living, but he's in very bad shape now. He was one of the forerunners in this thing. John Burton had come into town, and they were the sort of the crux of this political uprising movement, so far as the black people are concerned. And everybody got together and elected Frank Seymour to the city council, see? And then later on he was elected, he was never mayor, he was elected. You know, sometimes people will always find ways to keep you from getting in the thing. One of the things that happened, they passed a law, a bill, or something, wherein that you had to own property in the city to become a member of the city council or hold any kind of public office. See? Of course, at that time, Frank had planned on resigning and not getting back on the council anyway, so it didn't affect him. So he moved down to Detroit and established a public relations firm, see. And then we...
Was that just after one term on council?
I think he's only spent one term on the city council.
A term of 2 years.
Yes, term of 2 years. I'm trying to think now. Then Amos Washington... John, I can't think who was first, Amos Washington or John Burton, who was next on to the city council. But one of the two of those men, so close together I can't call now. We had a faction there that they changed the rules. In other words, instead of electing from wards, they went to district-wise, you see. And that's when... Amos ran. John Burton happened to be the second man who was to be elected to the council. So I told Amos that I thought that he could win, see, and Amos thought he could win too. A lot of people thought that that I was supporting Amos because I knew that we couldn't elect two blacks on the council, see, and I've always felt that I would never do anything to hurt the progress of the black man, never. But I figured if we stuck together, that we could place two people on the council. I knew that Amos had enough people on the south, enough relatives on the south side who could influence other people, and I knew he had enough friends on the other side of town because he had established himself to get enough votes. We're going to elect seven people, and right. Fresh. And I said, this will be the only time that we can elect two blacks at one time, see. We had quite a controversy on that, and I was branded a traitor, and I couldn't understand that because I figured that everybody had a right to his own opinion, and if I had thought that I was doing anything that would hurt the black people, I would not have done it, see. But I kept insisting that two people can be elected to the city council, see. Well, my name was Mudd, but however, when it came out, both John Burton and Amos Washington were elected to the city council as I had predicted they would be, and Amos Washington received the highest number of votes over all seven candidates, see. So, I mean, I felt real good about that, see. So, then, after the death of Dr. Lawrence Perry, who was the first member of our school board, Amos was now working for the Housing Commission. He got off the city council, see. He got off the city council because it was a conflict of interest for him to stay on the city council and be with the Housing Commission, see. So then he took the place of Dr. Perry on the school board. Dr. Perry was the first black ever to serve on the Ypsilanti school board, see. And then Amos Washington was appointed. Then after he was appointed, then he was re-elected again at the end of his term he was serving for Dr. Perry. Then after that, Douglas Harris was the third person to be represented on the school board, and which time I became elected. And we had two blacks at the same time on the school board. That's the only time.
Yeah, but there was a period in there when you didn't have any, though, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, from the time that Dr. Perry was the first.
Yeah.
See, Amos Washington filled out the term. Prior to Dr. Perry, there was nobody.
Yeah,
see?
Right.
And then Amos Washington filled out the term of Dr. Perry. See. All right. Then when Amos Washington got off the Housing Commission, J.D. Hall filled out the unexpired term of Amos Washington at the death of Amos Washington.
Yeah.
See. All right, then he was re-elected again, see. Then when he got off the board, he did not run. Douglas Harris was elected. He spent one term on the Board of Education. And he spent 1 year with me, see. I was elected in 1975, and he spent 1 year. Then he was not reelected. He was defeated, see. Then I was reelected to the board back in 1979, see. And now in the second year of a four-year term, see. And I think it's about time we start grooming somebody else to get on the board. But I think that's five people. Dr. Perry, Amos Washington, J.D. Hall, Doug Harris, and myself. We've had five blacks in the history of Ypsilanti to serve on the school board.
Well, that's starting sometime in the 40s.
Yes. Late 40s. Late 40s. Mm-hmm. Late 40s or early 50s.
Well, I know when I got here, J.D. was on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, but I guess the thing I'm interested in, Gene, is how do you bring this about? I mean, you were still only 15 to 18% of the total population.
And well,
how did you, tell me about the organization, the community organization that went into this election?
Well, we had an NAACP organization here at that time, and the blacks just got together. They got together and said it's about time that we stuck together. And what the blacks did, in other words, if you could elect two people, they only voted for one thing. And about the only way that we could get anything done is vote for one person. Because if you voted for two people, you voted for a black, then you voted for a white. And if you vote, you're always giving this other man a vote,
yeah,
see.
Right.
And when they were voting for two people, chances are they were voting for one man and another white man. They weren't voting.
Yeah.
So if the Negroes pulled their votes, you could do a lot of things. Even today, if Negroes could pull their votes, we'd be a power wherever we are, see. And but we have to stick together, see. And this is what was happening at that time, see. We're sticking together. See?
Now, you must have had a group. You must have had a group who was sitting back and sort of synthesizing these efforts. Now, I can visualize the man whose name you mentioned a while ago.
Ben Neely?
Ben Neely, mm-hmm. being one of those persons. Mm-hmm. Who else was involved in this? I'm talking about this nucleus group that you must have had that would come around and plan the strategy in order to take it to the people and so forth. Was that done directly through NAACP?
The Frank Seymour and Ben Neely and John Burton, they were some of the people. Now, we had a lot of women involved in there. Ms. Van Slyke, she's passed on. Ms. Ethel Williams was involved in that. It was a nucleus of people like that. They weren't always together. They weren't always together. The ideas weren't. The ideas were good, but they weren't polarized like they should have been. And it just happened, though, that the churches, all the churches, were pulling at the same time. See, and but if you want to see a nucleus of people, that got out there and actually fighting, it was a small group of people that got most of the people together. See. And of course, later on, people began to fight each other and pull one way and one the other. But we have managed to keep at least one black person on the city council ever since Frank Seymour was the first one. See.
I guess somewhere I picked up, I think this is right, there was a club of women. Some of the names that you mentioned were involved in it. But that this club actually got on the telephone and went around ringing bells and so forth to get people to get out to vote.
Well, there's so many clubs in town.
Well,
I don't really know the exact name of the club.
This was
about
the club that was involved in the community center.
Carver Center?
Yeah.
Carver Center.
Yeah.
Well, they're practical. As I say, there's Palm Leaf Club, there's a Kentucky Wonder Club, there's a Sewing Circle Club, and those are all women's clubs. Then we had the Jolly Men's Club, you know. There are a lot of different clubs, and they all work together.
They all, well, just saying, they all got out.
Yeah.
See, the story, when I heard from one person, and that person was telling me how that particular club had done this and done that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm hearing you say is, yes, that club may have done so and so and so and so, but there were other clubs
involved also.
Mm-hmm. In other words, it was more of a joint.
It was a joint thing. I don't think it could give one club all the credit, because they had people from all clubs. You know, may have been one or two people from each club, but this is what was happening in our city.
How much resistance was there to that from the white folks?
I don't think that it was too much resistance, because I don't think that they thought that